You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
You are listening to the number one horse podcast in the world. Here's your entertaining look at the horse world and the people in it.
I'm Julie Broadway, president of the American Horse Council.
And I'm Emily Stearns, Health, Welfare, and Regulatory Affairs Liaison for the American Horse Council.
And you are listening to the special monthly American Horse Council's episode of Horses in the Morning on the Horse Radio Network for April 2026. Good morning, Horse World.
It's time to hear from the American Horse Council in this monthly episode of Horses in the Morning.
Emily, today's topic is feral horse management. Now, a lot of people get confused. Feral horses differ from wild horses? So I looked it up and it said feral horses are free roaming horses of domesticated stock that have escaped or been released into the wild. They are not wild animals in the traditional sense, as they have domesticated ancestors.
And I think when we all think of, you know, wild horses, we think of Mustangs roaming around out in Wyoming and Montana and that kind of iconic imagery. And they're often, feral horses are often found in Western states, you know, like Nevada and Oregon and California and Wyoming. And many of us know about kind of the unique populations like the Chincoteague horses and the Carolina horses, but they're kind of everywhere at this point, all across the country.
Yep. So today we're going to explore what is sometimes perceived as a complicated topic. I'm with some great subject matter experts from the Science and Conservation Center, and Sarah Coleman is with us from the Kentucky State Horse Council, where they also have some challenges with feral horses in the state. So with that, we'll be right back to begin our interview. Today's episode is brought to you from Zoetis, who is a proud partner of the American Horse Council and has been supporting horses, riders, and veterinarians for over 70 years. They offer over 50 products from industry-leading vaccines to expert-recommended dewormers and other horse health solutions. Zoetis is always by your side to help you do what's right for your horse, and you can visit them at zoetisequine.com to learn more.
So today, we're excited to welcome the Science and Conservation Center. So Melissa and Kayla, I want to welcome you and just give you a moment to introduce yourselves.
I'm Kayla Grams, and I am the Senior Biologist for the Science Conservation Center. I've been doing this work a long time. I started out in 2002 studying wild horses out west, and I have been working with them ever since. I've been working out in the field quite a bit, monitoring horses, contracepting them, you know, in different states. And then I ended up here at the Science and Conservation Center where we make the PZP vaccine. And so I've been doing that. And I also train folks on how to utilize the PZP, the 3-day training course that encompasses biology, history, immunology, and how to use the dart guns if they're going to go out and dart horses, all sorts of information that educates you on what we do.
And Melissa, go ahead and introduce yourself too.
And hello, thanks for having me. My name is Melissa Esser. I am an equine veterinarian. I'm board certified in large animal internal medicine. Most of my career, I've spent working in veterinary colleges, teaching veterinary students and working in the hospital. But a couple of years ago, joined the Science and Conservation Center to be a part of solutions for free roaming horses. I'm also an owner of two horses. I'm an avid dressage rider with a little bit of endurance thrown in there.
Well, welcome. And then I also want to welcome Sarah Coleman, who I believe we've probably had on the show before. I can't imagine we haven't. She wears a lot of hats in the industry, and today she is repping Kentucky Horse Council. So Sarah, please talk about yourself for a minute.
Awesome. Thank you very much. My name is Sarah Coleman. I'm the executive director of the Kentucky Horse Council. We are best known for our welfare and educational outreach initiatives, and we have been dealing very specifically with addressing the free roaming horse population in Kentucky since about the end of 2020.
And just real quickly, So everybody knows Sarah Coleman was the recipient last year of our Van Ness Award at the American Horse Council Conference. That's given to someone who has made a big impact on our industry at the state level. And Sarah certainly wears a lot of hats and does a lot of things for us. So thanks again, Sarah.
Thank you.
So today we were talking about feral horses. And before we jump into our questions, I just want to kind of define for everybody. We say the word feral horse, but we're also talking about Mustangs on BLM land. We're talking about managed herds of free roaming horses. And we're also talking about unmanaged herds of free roaming horses. And a little bit of data, because that's where we always go, is there's an estimated 300,000 free roaming horses across the country. And so that is inclusive, just for everybody listening, that's inclusive of the about 75 to 85,000 Mustangs that BLM manages, both out in wild land areas and also as part of their feedlot operations, along with all these other herds of horses. So when we're talking about Mustangs, that only really represents about 25% of free roaming horses out there across the country. So SCC and Sarah, I would love you guys just for a minute to kind of help us talk about and define what a feral or free roaming horse is and kind of what those various populations look like. Sarah, do you want to take a stab at it first with what you see in Kentucky?
Absolutely. So I'll try to give you guys the nutshell version. I'm really passionate about this topic and could talk about it for hours and hours. But the population of what we consider free roaming horses in Kentucky is there's about 12 counties in eastern Kentucky that have populations of horses that at one point in time were all owned. It is basically what we consider our coal countries. These horses were originally turned out. There was a gentleman's agreement that there were no stallions turned out with these herds, and they were owned. They were taken up every spring. They were trail ridden throughout eastern Kentucky and then turned back out to graze and free roam across the reclaimed strip jobs in the winters. With the downturn of the economy in 2008, we ended up having a lot of formerly owned horses be turned out on those reclaimed strip jobs, including stallions. So the population out there has really escalated since about 2008. So what we run into is these horses do not act like the horses you were mentioning that we most think of, Emily. Like they're not Mustangs. They don't graze like Mustangs. They don't manage their young like Mustangs. It is not unusual in these counties in particular to see a mare be heavily bred, pregnant, be nursing her foal, be nursing her yearling, and have her two-year-old behind her. So it's a lot of physiological stress on those mares. And additionally, of course, there is the concern about them having limited feed and forage areas up there in these counties as well.
Right, because I think in Kentucky, people envision like the rolling hills down by thoroughbred country and kind of forget about, you know, all the nice mountains on part of eastern Kentucky where it comes up in the beautiful mountains over there. So in terms of what you see, like you just said, you feel like the Kentucky horses physiologically, behaviorally are very different from what a lot of people imagine and like those beautiful Mustangs running out west. SCC, Kayla and Melissa, do you guys want to talk a little bit about what you see in terms of the kinds of horses you're managing?
Yeah. So as you had mentioned, the word feral technically refers to an animal that has been domesticated, but has since been set free to live wild, where wild would suggest that animal has evolved in the geographic environment then and remains there. Some people would also say this is native or a native species. Among evolutionary scientists, there's some debate on whether horses on public lands are feral or wild. But another all-encompassing term that's used, which we've referred to here, that covers kind of both potential circumstances for feral horses on private and public land is free roaming. To get into the weeds just a little bit more, so when we talk about horses on public lands, the horses that are free roaming on certain areas of federal land have been designated as protected under the Wild Free Roaming Horses and Burros Act of 1971. What these horses typically look like can vary quite a bit, and some of that depends on their origins. These populations of free roaming horses can range from smaller herds, like 50 to 100 horses to very, very large herds, maybe in the thousands. They can be living in residential communities occasionally. And then sometimes they're on large, vast expanses of public land. Within a herd, typically, the horses will maintain a social structure where there is one dominant stallion and then one or more mares that he keeps together. This social structure is usually maintained throughout the year, which is a bit different than, say, deer or elk. However, in some areas, there are some exceptions. Occasionally, what we call a harem, so that might be a family group in how we referred that, they may have accessory stallions that would follow along nearby, perhaps looking for an opportunity. And as far as, like I said, physical appearance, it just really can range. They can be pony size, so maybe 13 hands high, all the way to draft size. And as I said, a lot of that depends on maybe their origins. If they're more in the feral category, they've been let loose, then it kind of depends on what they were doing as a job before that lends itself to kind of what they look like. The colors that we see just range the gamut. Many of the horses or the colors that we see in domestic horses, we also see out on the range, but the amounts of certain colors vary from place to place.
Had no idea it was that diverse. Wow. Well, talk a minute to us guys about why controlling this horse population is so important. I think we have such a broad and deep background of folks that participate in this podcast. And my guess is that some of them have had misinformation or maybe had a lot of different stories about this. So give us your expertise here. Why is it important to control that population? Kayla, you want to start me off?
Yes, it's very important. We want to see healthy horses and healthy rangelands. And it's so critical to have a range, not just for the horses, but also for the ecosystem as well. A lot of these public lands that have the wild horses, they basically are on a multi-use land with the agency. And so that multi-use means that there's also cattle and sheep, but there's also wildlife there. If they don't have resources like food or water, then that becomes difficult for the whole ecosystem. The BLM kind of basically says that they need to maintain a thriving natural ecological balance on the public lands. And that means everything that they're balancing out there. If you're not managing that population, there can be overpopulation, there can be overgrazing, and that's not good for the land. We want to make sure that the land basically is good. And if that disappears, that land may not be able to recover. The horse's reproductive rate is high. And so you have maybe a 20% growth rate average per year. And there's few natural predators as well. And so having, you know, climate change that's increased in terms of drought and fire and lack of those resources, that's going to put the range at risk and that may not be able to recover. So it's really important to have that population controlled so that that whole ecosystem can thrive. Horses not on public lands is just as important. If you have horses that are not on our, say, public lands, basically they can also get out of control. They kind of encroach on residential neighborhoods sometimes. We have some herd areas that work with horses that are living in some of these residential areas, trying to work with that. And there's a risk of those horses also getting hit by vehicles as well, especially as the populations increase. You get a lot more activity on the road, and that can be detrimental to both the person in the car that may hit the horse or the horse itself. So it's really important to have those healthy range lands to be able to sustain those populations.
And I think that's a good discussion point too. Like, we're talking about the dichotomy of horses, free roaming horses out on rangelands, and then kind of more like the populations that Sarah's helping to manage. So Sarah, what are the issues you see in these horses that, you know, they're closer to residential areas, they're operating more kind of where people are?
For sure. So that is actually probably the number one concern that we have is, so these herds, it kind of varies between our 12 free roaming counties, right? Like a couple of these counties, they actually utilize these herds as tourism draws. So you can go up there when the horses hear the sound of the vehicles, they'll come up to the vehicles. You can feed them. They're fed all sorts of things, everything you can imagine that we don't necessarily prefer. And then in some of our further out counties, these horses, when they hear a car, they're gone. What we run into a lot of times is exactly what Kayla was mentioning, is in the winter when the foraging options kind of get very limited, they will start to come down the mountains. They'll go into people's yards. They've damaged houses. They've damaged cars. What the majority of the concern that we have more than anything is that they get in the roads in the winter and lick the salt off the roads. So they become very much a public nuisance, but also a hazard to drivers as well. So again, it's multifaceted. We are concerned with public safety, of course, but we're also really worried about the welfare for the horses as well. And I will just mention that we are not protective of our Eastern Kentucky herds. Our goal would eventually be, in theory, to run it down to zero, because these horses are being free roamed in areas that they are not legally allowed to be in. So it is more, you know, we're not protecting the wild Mustangs. We are basically just trying to create a situation where this population decades from now will be run down to zero, and those horses that are up there are, at least as we're working on it, being able to be cared for in the meantime.
That's a great point too, right? So the two different goals, and I think that kind of leads into our next question. The methods for controlling these horse populations, there's two different goals. There's manage them in a way the environment and the horse is thriving, and then there's managing it in a way that they're safely and humanely ultimately removed from the property area. So Sarah, why don't you start first? What are some of the kind of the standard methods for controlling these free roaming horses in your area?
Sure. So the Kentucky Horse Council works really closely with two different organizations within the state of Kentucky. One is the Kentucky Humane Society, and the second is the Appalachian Horse Project. We basically kind of look at a three-pronged approach. So to back up a half a step, a lot of the horses that are turned out on these strip jobs are still owned, you know, or they're offspring of owned horses. So one of the prongs that we utilize is what we call drop and geld. So as long as the horse has an owner and it is a stallion, they can come up to the horse council and say, hey, I don't really want my horse to be a stallion, but I don't have money to geld him, but we're open to having him gelded. So we work really closely with Lexington Equine Medical Group. We will go out there, we'll dart the horse, dart the stallion, put him on the ground, and we'll drop and geld on the top of these strip jobs. So that's the one prong approach we take. The second prong approach, now to be very clear, the Horse Council does not take in horses. We are not an adoption or rescue organization. We basically are kind of just another cog in the wheel to try to help these horses get care. So we do a lot of connecting, networking, grant requests to try to facilitate the removal into adoption and rescue organizations of the horses that are in poor condition. So that's kind of the second prong. First is gelding the stallions. The second is removing horses that are in pretty perilous welfare conditions, whether it's because they're thin or because they're injured or because they're nuisance horses, which is what we call the ones that are getting in the road. And then the third prong approach that we've just really been able to launch this past year is the administering of PZP, which is an contraceptive that we see that as kind of being, you know, the epitome of what we can do. We all know this, but we can geld as many stallions as possible. But if there's still one stallion in that herd, those mares are most likely going to get bred. So we're really excited to be able to kind of launch this third prong approach that we will hopefully be able to see some pretty immediate results within those populations in the next year or so.
So SCC, do you guys want to talk a little bit about what management looks like out on the rangelands?
Yeah, the standard method to control feral horse populations on public land has included two main programs. The first one is gathering the horses, removing excess horses, and the second one has been fertility control, or some combination of both of those two activities. The horses that are removed after a gather are generally placed in adoption programs. However, not all horses are adopted or adoptable, and these excess horses are then placed in holding facilities, which sometimes they'll stay in for the rest of their lives and require care for that period of time. Currently, these holding facilities are nearly full, yet, as you had mentioned, Emily, at the beginning, there's still a significant number of excess horses that are out on public lands that are needing to be removed for those healthy rangelands.
So we have kind of the combination of the physical removal and then some of the fertility aspects as well. Julie, did you have something you wanted to ask?
Yeah, I was just going to comment that a couple of years ago, I heard a presentation at the American Association of Equine Practitioners where they were talking about the ecosystem and how other animals, species, et cetera, are affected, and exactly what Kayla was saying about foraging and what's available and how the land can be severely damaged with a large population. And it was fascinating to me to read the room and see mixed feelings for people of there's horses out here that can't find water or can't find food. And they look to me in the photos like they're starving to death. Like I was concerned for their welfare in those conditions. And yet people are also of the opinion of we should leave them alone and let them do whatever they do. And I'm like, oh, goodness gracious. So my question is, if we were going to pick one of these methods, what's the pros and cons of these different methods? And how does a fertility control immunization work just medically?
I can start with kind of the pros and cons. So basically, fertility control, pros, basically, you're going to have a healthier horse. You're not going to have that mare that is, you know, basically lactating all the time. She's got a suckling foal with her all the time and that it's going to eliminate that. And she's going to be a lot healthier in that, which is good. And that's going to help, you know, with the rangelands as well. So, you know, fertility control, you know, maybe you don't have to gather as often if you're doing fertility control. Like Sarah said, maybe you just want to zero it out and that's okay too. It just kind of depends on what the plan is. And that the healthier horses do the PZP immunocontraceptive, super, super good. Cons, you can't, at least with public lands, you can't always approach them. There's some herd areas that are, there's not a lot of human activity. You don't see horses that often. And it's so vast that when you do get out there, it's maybe hard to locate them as well. So you may not be able to apply fertility control based off of that. You know, other strategies can be implemented, but unless you're getting about 65% or maybe a little bit more, you're not going to make an impact on that population because a lot of the mares is going to continue to breed. And so it's, you know, the contraceptive, if you do a little bit, that's great. And that's helpful for sure, but you aren't going to necessarily make that population impact. And
so it really needs to be like a combo approach.
So, yeah, we would say that the agencies have said, well, we just want to, there's a certain animal management level that they have a high and a low, and they want to get to that level, that low level, before they apply fertility control. Well, it's cyclical. You're just going to continue. They're going to continue to breed out there. They may not be able to gather everybody. You know, the cons basically with strategic gathers is that, you know, people don't like them at all. There's a lot of negativity with the public against that in itself. It's stressful for the horses. That helicopter is pushing them in, and that can result in injuries and death. And nobody wants to see that. But sometimes you have to gather, especially some of these larger herds where you're not going to be able to bait trap. And bait trap is beneficial in certain circumstances, but the helicopter is going to be able to access areas that most people can't get into. And that's really critical and that's important. And then the pros also for that gather is just that you can apply fertility control. So we always say, you know, if you can bring some in, you might have to remove some, but also apply fertility control to some of these mares, push them back out there again so that you can build on that so that you don't have everybody breeding out there. And that's benefit. So adoption programs are positive because with adoptions, you know, people that love these magnificent horses, they can adopt one of the horses from the herd areas that they follow and that they love. And training can be quite different with Mustangs as compared to domestic horses. But you're going to reduce the number of horses that are placed in long-term care if you're adopting them out. But there's still too many horses in long-term holding in that. It's hard to... The numbers are staggering in terms of the amount that are on range, but there's about 62,000 plus horses that are in off long-term, short-term holding, waiting to be adopted. And not everybody's going to adopt a horse. A lot of people do, but it's, you know, it's one tool that you can use, but there are other tools that would need to be used as well. Long-term holding, the care, you know, the care that they get is a positive, They live out their lives getting food and water. They don't have to try to survive. They stay healthy. But the con is that, you know, the taxpayer cost is large for holding these horses the rest of their lives and that. And a lot of the percentage of the BLM budget for wild horses specifically, that goes to the long-term care. So they don't have a lot of money left over to maybe do range improvements or do fertility control to the extent that they could. So those are just some of the pros and cons.
The cost of the long-term holding, I feel like, is one of those, okay, well, we need funds to do the on-range management. Mm-hmm. Can't get rid of the horses in holding for a whole variety of reasons. So the funds need to take care of those horses. Nobody at the federal level is willing to increase budget anymore to throw at either side of things. So we're kind of just in a stalemate either way, management wise, I feel like, for those horses.
Right. Well, and I think in the past too, and I don't know, I don't know as much anymore, but there still is. The public had a lot of outcry. And so the public basically, you know, said, we don't like the way they're being managed. We want them to be managed that way, this way, and leave them alone. And, you know, although we call them free roaming horses, at least on BLM lands, they're fenced in. I mean, they really can't free roam other places to find other resources. And not that they don't, because sometimes they get over fences or cattle guards, but in general, it's, you have to manage that land accordingly, you know, based on what you have on the land there. So it is, it's a difficult task by the BLM. It's tricky in terms of how they have to manage and appeal to the public as well.
So Sarah, do you want to just chime in a little bit? Because I'm sure the management for these more kind of residential free roaming horses isn't outrageously different, but I'm sure there's also some kind of other pros and cons in terms of the strategies that vary just based on the sheer fact that these horses are, you know, in residential areas, being rose to hazards, being kind of dangers to the public to a certain point, and having that kind of more welfare crisis as well.
There is. So pretty much what we have attempted to do, and I give all credit to Lori Redman of Kentucky Humane. She is really the one who is the first call, because we don't take horses. Lori is very much the first person they call when there's horses in the road. So what we try to do is if we have the ability, is to network and get at least the population that's coming down, because our herds vary. They're probably, I don't actually know what size BLM herds are. This I'm learning as well. But ours vary anywhere from like 10 to 15 horses up to about 40. So the bigger herds don't usually tend to come down in the roads and become nuisances. But those 10 to 15, when you think about going from a full adoption or rescue, and then all of a sudden somebody's like, hey, I've got 15 that we need to get off the road ASAP. You know, we struggle with that. So Lori is wonderful. We work really closely with ASPCA and have received some grant funding from them as well when we have to do what we consider our immediate intakes. So we do actually try to take those road horses as soon as possible that the county judge executive gives us the opportunity to do that. So in the state of Kentucky, county is king. So we have 120 counties in Kentucky, and we have to have permission from every judge executive to remove horses, even if they're in the road and being a nuisance. We have to have permission. So sometimes when it's like any elected official, right, when they get enough pressure from their voters in their county to do something with the horses, is normally when we get the calls to come in and remove what they consider the nuisance horses or even horses that are injured. That has really kind of opened the door for us. We try to do, you know, let us show you how we can help you, and then let us look further range into administering PZP and drop and geld. So once they kind of know that we're on their team, right, we all want what's best for the horses and what's best for public safety. Once we have kind of shown them, yep, we're on your team, we got your back, we're going to do the best that we can do, then we say, hey, why don't we talk about what else we can do to kind of, you know, prevent this from being a 911 situation that the horses are in the roads. So, and I will be very honest, this is with those, we're talking very specifically about those counties that the horses are much more people broke, for lack of a better term. We're not talking about those counties where you go up and the horses are, you know, truly running for the hills. So that's going to be, we are just starting to expand in those counties, and that's going to be a very different ballgame, that's for sure.
How do you know if those horses are owned?
So it's probably just like everywhere else, is these communities, equine communities everywhere, are pretty tight knit. So what we'll do is we'll find one horse owner or one person who is, you know, knows us and trusts us in that county, and say, hey, specifically with the gelding, right? We'll be like, hey, Bernice of Appalachian Horse Project knows so-and-so up in Knott County that has some horses out there, and they will kind of become our spokesperson and go around and just say, hey, Joe, I know you got that red colt up there. Do you want him to stay intact, or can we help you? So it is very much utilizing people within that community that are already known and trusted.
That makes perfect sense, that you're trying to do all the networking and all the coalition building that you can, so that you don't end up with some backlash for good intentions, you know, kind of.
Exactly.
I totally get that. So let's talk a minute about these fertility control immunizations. What kind of products are available, and how do you administer them? I know you talked about the dart gun method kind of thing. Are there a lot of different ways to go about this?
Yeah, for administration, basically dart projectors is what we call them. And so you basically approach on foot or by vehicle. You can be in a blind. Sometimes blinds work, sometimes not. You use a 1cc barbless needle and you dart the animal in the hip, the muscle. And basically that dart, once the vaccine is injected, it pops right back out again. And so that's good, because then you can go retrieve the dart, make sure that it went off. When they're gathered, they're placed, they're brought in, they run through a chute, and then you also basically inject them by hand in that chute. So that's how they're administered. We have to mix the vaccine with, there's an adjuvant and the vaccine itself. And because the adjuvant is more oil-based, PZP is more water-based. We have glass syringes that we mix the vaccine with, and then that's placed in that dart. So it's a little bit of a process.
Do the people that are utilizing the darts have to be, for lack of a better word, trained in the use of firearms, you know, have the necessary paperwork in order to help you guys do this kind of thing?
We don't have them. We don't require them to be trained in firearms. Now, depending on your group that you're working with, we have a lot of volunteer groups that work with the agencies to go out and dart horses. It may be based off of their group. Like they may require, like, yes, you need to get a little bit of firearm training, but generally we teach a class, that three-day class. They come, they learn how to use dart guns. They learn everything there is to know about PZP, and they learn how to mix the vaccine. And basically they kind of learn how to use those dart projectors, and we teach a little bit of gun safety as well, so they understand that. Some people come with already a wealth of knowledge about firearms and have used firearms extensively, and so that's a benefit. But yeah, we don't really have a requirement for the dart guns and use of them.
Is PZP used at all in like domestic horses, or is it pretty much a product strictly reserved for free roaming horses?
The PZP is labeled only for use in free roaming horses in burros living on public lands, or those in sort of privately managed sanctuaries. So it's not commercially available for domestic horses at this point in time.
So as we start to wrap up this conversation a little bit, tell me, Sarah, I'll start with you. If there are people out here that are hearing this podcast and they think, oh gosh, I'd like to volunteer, I'd like to be involved in part of this, how do they go about doing that?
They are more than welcome to email me. My email is Sarah, S-A-R-A-H, at KentuckyHorse.org, or pop over to our website. But I will say we work very specifically around the veterinary practice that helps us most. They are mainly thoroughbred repro specialists. So we don't do a lot of gelding until the weather kind of cools off. But Kentucky Humane Society is administering PZP right now, and I am more than happy to get anybody in touch with them.
Awesome. So, Melissa or Kayla, if people would like to be part of your network and your volunteer force, how do they go about doing that?
We've got two ways they can access information about our organization and PZP. One is our website, so that's www.scc.org. pzp.org, or our email, that's contact@sccpzp.org. And we would be happy to go into more detail about what we touched on today or answer any questions that anybody has.
Awesome. Em, do you have a closing question or comment?
I think this is just one of those topics we could talk about for a long time. I know there's probably like three or four questions I still want to ask that we don't have time for today, but it's definitely anybody out there, feel free to reach out to us and check out the show notes. And you're welcome to reach out to Sarah at Kentucky Humane or SCC for more questions.
Yeah. If there was one thing you wanted people to take away from this conversation, Sarah, I'll start with you. What would that be? What would you want them to really get out of this?
I would probably want them to know that Kentucky does have free roaming horses, and we have more breeds than just the thoroughbreds that we're probably best known for, and we're proud of all of them.
Great. Melissa, you got anything you really want people to take away from this?
I would like people to just know fertility control exists. It's highly successful and it's very safe for horses and is a really valuable tool in our toolbox to help manage overpopulation of horses.
Awesome. Kayla, anything else you want to add?
Education is important. There's a lot of misinformation out there. And so be educated and come to the source. Talk to the people that are doing the work. That's really important because sometimes rumors can be started and then it gets passed on. And that's where that misinformation happens in that. But we love talking to people. So, you know, give us a call even. You know, we just enjoy telling people about PZP, immunocontraceptive, and what we do.
Awesome. Well, we want to thank you ladies for joining us today. And what I repeat what Emily said, if you heard something that piqued your curiosity out of this, we've got some contact information in the show notes for our guest. And you can always contact us at the Horse Council at info@horsecouncil.org. And we'll be happy to put you in touch with some people or try to answer your question if we think we can. Thank you again. So our legislative and regulatory update is brought to you by one of the American Horse Council's sponsors, which is fitting for this particular segment, and it is the Wild Horse Refuge, which is a private nonprofit sanctuary dedicated exclusively to rescuing Mustangs removed from the Colorado herd management area. They take these iconic wild horses and let them now roam freely across 47 square miles of protected contiguous land, giving them back their freedom and keeping them from those kinds of challenges that we've been talking about earlier. Right now, they have about 250 Mustangs on the property, and the property itself is 30 miles from the San Wash Basin and under 40 miles from the Pennis East Douglas HMA. So it's great, some great work they're doing. If you get a chance to go out there and take a tour, it's amazing the work that they're doing. So hats off to the Wild Horse Refuge for all of their efforts. So folks, today we've been talking about how wild horse and burros are managed in the U.S., focusing specifically on the regulatory framework behind it is what we want to talk about as part of our legislative and regulatory update.
And we basically wanted to make sure that, you know, we started the conversation today talking about free roaming horses, so that 300,000 number. We're going to keep putting that number out there so everybody just understands how big it is. But the foundation of the government-managed horses, so the wild Mustangs, that kind of 75, 85,000-ish number out on the rangelands, is the Wild Free Roaming Horses and Burros Act of 1971. And that establishes federal authority and sets out how these animals are managed on the public lands.
So start me off at the high level and tell me, what does this law actually mandate, Emily?
Yeah, so it places wild horses and burros under federal jurisdiction and assigns management responsibility specifically to the Bureau of Land Management and also the U.S. Forest Service. So these agencies are responsible not just for the animals, but also for managing them kind of within the broader context of the public lands they're living on.
So before I go any further, I have a little side question. So can someone who has a small herd that are free roaming anywhere, pick a state, call up and say, hey, we want to raise our hand and we'd like our herd to now be covered by this so that they are getting some additional governmental support. Is that how this works? Or does the government get to decide which ones qualify for this particular piece of legislation?
No. So it's very specific. The legislation only covers areas where horses were existing when the act was written in 1971. So the act operates kind of within this larger multiple use framework. So agencies, they have to consider the wildlife, the livestock grazing, the recreation. But again, it's only where horses were present in those areas when the law was written in 1971.
You probably remember, it's been in about a year or so ago, I got a call from a gentleman who had a small herd off a little island, I think close to Georgia. And he knew about the Outer Banks herds and some of those others that have some other resources to help them. And he was trying to figure out how he was going to navigate that. So I'm sure if he's listening, he's really thinking through this thing at this point. But the law doesn't apply everywhere. It only applies, you said, to wild horses and burros located on federal lands where they were present in 71.
Yes. And so when there's populations in other areas, like we just talked about with SEC and Sarah Coleman, on private land and in these state-managed areas, management is handled by either the landowner, who can dictate if they want them removed or contained, or if they're kind of owned, kind of like Sarah was talking about with some of her situations, they can get ownership transferred. But that all depends on the state regulations and on state-specific lands. So something like the horses on Assateague Island, some of those are managed by the state of Virginia. Agencies can create their own policies, and that can include population control programs, partnerships with other areas or rescues, kind of like Kentucky's doing, or coordinating with local governments. And Julie, I know you bring up often, you talk about horses on tribal lands and the experiences those groups have. So is there anything particular about the tribal land management systems?
Well, we said earlier in the interview, you know, these horses know no boundaries, basically, and they wander from place to place. So it's not uncommon for the Intertribal Council in Washington to contact us and want to talk a little bit about some of the challenges that they're having. They really resonated with what Sarah said, like in 2007, 2008, when we went through the recession, that they saw more horses getting dropped off on their land. And they're very cognizant of that. And of course, those horses have been domesticated and don't come with the skills or the expertise to suddenly survive out there on Native American lands. And so it was really a challenge for them. So I'm just was curious about, you know, if there was anything different about the way that's handled than any of the other kind of things that happen in various states.
Mm-hmm. And so bringing it back to the federal law and the horses on the BLM lands, and SEC had brought this up too, is one of the key requirements, the specific language in the Wild Horses and Burro Act is maintaining what's called a thriving natural ecological balance. And I'm putting that in quotes because it's the language from the act. And that's the central, what they call the regulatory standard. So agencies are required to manage those populations in a way that aligns with kind of the overall land conditions, not just the specific number of animals, the number of horses, and what's determined as the appropriate number of horses in a herd management area is based on striving towards that thriving natural ecological balance.
So a lot of people think this is based on herd size, and it's not based on herd size necessarily.
Yeah, so they include factors like the amount and types of vegetation, water availability, wildlife availability, and kind of other authorized land uses. So sometimes that includes cattle grazing rights. Sometimes that includes safe recreation, all that kind of stuff.
Hmm. So how do the agencies turn that into an actual decision, a management decision?
So they establish what are called appropriate management levels, or AMLs, and those population ranges are determined through land use planning and environmental analysis and monitoring data.
Okay, so what you're telling me is AML, appropriate management levels, reflects what the land can support under the current conditions. And when the population exceeds that level, the law requires the agencies to determine whether there are excess animals present and then come up with a plan.
Yes, exactly. And so if there are too many animals, the act directs their removal. And that process is part of the statutory framework. So identify excess animals, remove them, and then manage what happens next.
Okay, so that brings us back to what happens after removal.
Yep. And so the primary pathway is adoption, and this is in an ideal world. So, and what BLM always strives to do with animals that are removed from the range. So horses removed from the range are put up for adoption. Individuals can adopt animals through the federal program, and the ownership title, so the title of ownership, transfers to you once you buy the horse after a certain time period. Mm-hmm. And the ideal goal for that, and again, as always with us, we're kind of staying neutral. It's not our job to tell you what's perfect and what's not perfect, but the Pollyanna goal of that is that it encourages people to retain ownership of the horses long term and theoretically stops them from ending up in auction pipelines. We know there's been issues with this process, so this conversation isn't about those issues. This is just about what the specific steps and ideal steps are.
So if they put them up for adoption and they don't get adopted, then what?
So they can be placed in short-term or long-term holding facilities or managed under what authorities established through kind of legislation and policy, so in those feedlot areas. And typically a horse is put up for adoption two or three times, and horses that aren't adopted after several attempts are branded most of the time as a sale authority, and they can be sold for $25 with the title of ownership being immediately released to the buyer. So it's kind of supposed to be incentive to move these horses along faster if they don't get adopted through the normal auction process. The Act also states that the secretary shall cause additional excess wild free-roaming horses in burros for which an adoption demand by qualified individuals does not exist, they can be destroyed in the most humane and cost-efficient manner possible. So again, that's all in quotes from the Act. And what that means is there's the potential for them to legally be able to euthanize animals that are not adopted. And it's also really important to note that it is illegal for the government to sell horses to slaughter. And the government does not purposefully sell horses to slaughter. And however, again, we're just laying out the facts here and not making comment either way. Once the title of ownership is transferred to a buyer, that horse is legally their property that they can sell whichever way they want. So this is how horses coming off BLM lands can end up in the auction or slaughter pipeline.
Well, I hope everybody understands that what we've been trying to outline sort of tells you the agencies have a defined set of options. They're not just sort of making decisions on the fly.
Yeah, exactly. And so these are structured authorities outlined in the law and refined through regulation.
So one more question, I think, at least I've got here, because there's a lot to process with this, is are removals the only tools that the agencies can use?
No, and we kind of just talked about that, right? So they use fertility control. There's different aspects of how they manage the horses in the herd management area. Sometimes they feed horses. Sometimes they just remove horses. So again, it all goes through that environmental review process.
Awesome. So what kind of oversight exists just in the bigger picture?
So again, there's the land management is guided by land use plans, and that's all subjected to the administrative process, which we all know and love going through the regulatory process. And that's influenced by congressional funding and policy decision, which again, you know, we all know is functioning very, very well right now.
Okay. So one more time. It's a really layered approach. You've got statute, you've got regulation, you've got the planning, you've got the oversight, all working in concert together. The law establishes the federal authority over specific populations, defines where that authority applies, sets the standards for the ecological balance, requires action when populations exceed their limits, provides tools for how they go about enacting all of that, and it only applies to the defined subset of horses and burros that are in the U.S.
Yep, so only the 25% of all those 300,000 free-roaming horses that are on lands that were existing in 1971.
Okay, so this isn't just a single program. It's a regulatory system tied to public land management.
Exactly. And understanding how that system works, including where it applies and where it doesn't, is really key to understanding wild horse and burro management in the United States. So one key thing to note is that a lot of this process is overseen by the National Wild Horse and Burro Advisory Board, and that's composed of subject matter experts and representatives from multiple groups and stakeholders and the general public. And nominations for that are now open for the board and are being accepted until April 13th. And so I'll put the link in the show notes for that. But anyone that wants to nominate someone, there's three seats open if you're looking to try to get involved.
Well, and Emily, I'm just going to close by saying, so everybody's aware, we are always advocating for more equine industry experts to serve on these boards. This is a great example. We just had another one that was tell me what the name of it was, Emily, the ranch.
Oh, the FRRCC, the Federal Ranch. Oh, it's through EPA. It's a lot of letters, but it's the Federal Ranch Committee, yeah. Rural Ranch Committee, something like that.
Yeah. So I just throw that out there. So if you're listening to this and you've got an interest in a particular subject matter, check our website or join the AHC so you get our newsletter, because we're constantly posting these board, advisory board position opportunities or other committees that we're seeking to find somebody to represent the industry on that. So thanks, Em. That was a good lesson. Well, thank you for joining us today. We'll provide more information, numbers, links in the show notes. We invite you to support our beloved industry and join the American Horse Council. You can earn a free subscription to our monthly newsletter as well as other publications. We share what is the latest in all the legislative happenings, both federal and state, as well as information that we think horse owners like you need to know.
And you can follow the American Horse Council on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, X, formerly Twitter, and LinkedIn. And you can also subscribe to this podcast's RSS feed. You can subscribe to Horses in the Morning on any podcast player and find all the shows, including ours, on the Horse Radio Network at horseradionetwork.com.
And as we like to say, we are #HereForHorses.